Welcome. We're delighted to have you with us. We have been doing a series on human emotions. Jesus had them as a human, and our series is entitled Jesus Wept, the Bible and Human Emotions. And this is number 11 in that series. It's entitled Freedom from Addictions. Now, you might immediately raise a question in your mind, what do addictions have to do with emotions? Well, we'll see if we can find out in the next few minutes while we're together. We'd like you to join us in a word of prayer as we begin. Our loving Father, we appreciate the fact that you recognize every part of our existence, all that we are made of, our physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, social aspects. And now as we consider another part of the human experience, may it be enlightening, educational, and may it draw us nearer to you, is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Mm-hmm. We always need to start out probably with a few definitions, unless the subject is very, very familiar to people. So let me ask you, what is an addiction?
A compulsion or a habit?
A compulsion or a habit? Anybody want to add anything to that? Could you have a good addiction?
Something you think you can't get along without.
Something you can't get along without, like air, maybe food. Are those addictions? Well, they are for some people, not air necessarily. Yeah. But what drives addictive behavior?
Pain, pleasure.
Pain and pleasure?
The brain.
Does everybody have some kind of an addiction?
The tendency is there.
The tendency is there.
I think it seems to be in most of us.
Is addiction a felt need that's unfulfilled and the addiction fills it?
Temporarily.
Maybe, yeah. We would suggest that addictions are perhaps created needs, something that you've gotten accustomed to doing or something, taking in or whatever, and then you feel like you can't survive unless you have more. Did God design us to have addictions?
I'm suspecting not.
You're suspecting not.
We think of addiction in kind of negative term.
Yeah.
Right? Is there a positive side to addiction?
Well, let's, you know, Joanne already suggested that maybe it has something to do with habits. Habits have a lot of positive aspects to them. Let me give you an example. Suppose every morning you got up, you had to rethink everything you did. You had to figure out how to put on your clothes. You had to figure out how to brush your teeth. You had to start, what's this toothbrush for? What's this toothpaste for? I mean, we'd never get past the first hour in the morning.
But we all know about good habits and bad habits.
Yeah.
That doesn't carry the same negative connotation that addiction does.
And I agree with you. So,
doesn't this come back to freedom of choice?
Okay, say more.
Well, we're made to have a freedom of choice, and addictions kind of come into that area. We talk about alcoholism and drug addiction, but in most cases, nobody got them down and crammed it down them every day for a week to make them an addict. There's a choice made somewhere.
Yeah.
And if it's in the nature of drugs or alcohol or something of that nature that has a chemical effect on the brain, it can damage those things, and they're not generally maybe can limit or the effect, but the damage is done. And I understand that, let's say, a heroin addict, if they had got off it, but if they ever were to go back on, they'd go back at about the same level that they left it the first time.
Yeah.
As far as the depth of
the addiction. The same applies to tobacco.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Identify a good addiction.
Well,
exercise.
Let's talk about that. Some people would say that some people are addicted to work. We call them workaholics.
But that's negative. We don't call that a good thing if they're addicted to work.
Well, the boss thinks it's a good thing.
We're talking about you.
Well, addiction always seems like something inappropriate, for sure.
Uh-huh.
I don't ever see anything positive about it.
So we can get rid of the word addiction for good things.
Well, okay.
Or good things taken to extreme might be an addiction.
I belong to a gym, and exercise is a good addiction. But sometimes, no matter what day of the night, what day of the week, you will always find certain people there. And maybe that's an addiction gone too far, but they sure do look good.
But isn't that where the word temperance comes in?
Yes. We'll talk more about that.
I think maybe you could call it a perceived need. It's not the same as air and nourishment and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yes, Don.
My dad was addicted to work. Uh-huh. And every chance he got, he wouldn't work on the Sabbath, but he'd go in Saturday night to work many times. And whenever he got a chance to work, he would work.
I see.
And he didn't just play around. When my dad worked, he worked. Uh-huh.
Now, are you saying that's good? Did the family suffer because of that?
They suffered for lack of him being home. Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it is negative, and so it's an addiction at that point?
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
I think that Carrie might have had something there with the addiction taking away your freedom of choice. And anything that takes away our freedom of choice takes away our freedom to choose God, perhaps, and our freedom to choose other things, right? Mm-hmm. I think there may be something to what Carrie had to say about that.
Now, well, what about the children that are born from addicts? They say they have more of a tendency to become addicts of some sort.
Yeah.
They have an addictive personality, they say. What is...
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, many of us have an addictive personality. It's called obsessive compulsive. It runs on the same genes. And a lot of us who tend to be driving people are prone to addiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we sometimes are very proud to say that we as Seventh-day Adventists have held a very strong position about some kinds of addictions. We have we've developed programs to help people with alcoholism, smoking tobacco, even drug dependence. But although we recognize these addictions have enslaved millions, for the most part our membership have been fairly free from it because we have taken these fairly strong conditions. But there are other kinds of addictions which we may not be doing quite so well. Addictions create dependence and tolerance. Those are probably the two defining words for an addiction.
From a chemical standpoint?
From a chemical, well, but maybe even the other kinds of addictions. But let's talk about the chemical part to start out with. Dependence means people feel like they can't get along without it. They have to have it. And tolerance tends to mean that if you get a certain amount today, there's a very good likelihood that you want at least that much and perhaps a little bit more tomorrow, and always you need a little bit more and you need a little bit more. To get the same effect. So those are a couple of the characteristics that usually put along with the idea of addiction.
So you kind of go downhill in some respect, that it gets worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
Like
it tends to.
I heard of people who have sex addiction. Addiction. And it gets more and more...
compelling?
Kinky. I don't know what else you could say. Yeah. But, you know, it seems like it just deteriorates, you know, as it goes along.
With the young kids, there's the video game addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And then they might want more and more violent video games, more time, until they're just spending all sorts of time with the computer and isolated from everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, overcoming addictions is not easy. If it was something we just lay aside at will, then probably we wouldn't be talking about it, right? For many addictions, if not virtually all of them, when someone apparently recovers and then slips back, and we've mentioned this already, they tend to go right back to where they were in the same level of hole that they were in before they supposedly recovered. Recovering addicts need friends, family, maybe the church if they have a very understanding church, and God in order to successfully recover and remain that way. And the most famous sort of religious-based addictions recovery program that around the world is probably the 12-step program for recovery from alcoholism. And, you know, that's absolutely based on the idea that we need dependence on a power outside of and above ourselves. And it has, I mean, there's no other program that I know about in alcoholism that has come even close to the success of the 12. Now, there's variations in the 12-step program, but basically that program has been very, very successful. Jesus, when he was here on this earth, spoke to different groups of people in different ways. He had a very interesting conversation with some people described in John 8, and let's go there for a moment. The first 11 verses, I'm sorry, of that chapter talks about this woman who was caught in the very act of committing adultery. They had brought her to Jesus to try to trap him. And then Jesus responds. He realized, he knows that all that, and that's the woman taken in adultery. We don't have time to discuss that parable right now.
They didn't bring the man that was involved.
They didn't bring the man that was involved. They didn't follow the rules at all. Their purpose was one thing only, and that was to catch Jesus, to trap Jesus. And Jesus responded with some pretty remarkable things to say. Jesus spoke to the Pharisees again, and then he starts out, "I'm the light of the world." And they responded, "Oh, no, you're just talking about yourself." And Jesus said, "Well, I have other witnesses." And then he explains those witnesses. And we don't have time to go through all of that. And finally, Jesus said, "You know, I'm going to go away. You'll look for me and you won't find me. You'll die in your sins." And they said, "Where do you think you're going that we can't go?" You know, they felt like they were rich and powerful. And here's a poor man standing in front of them. Where is he going to go that they can't go? "You belong to this world," Jesus said, "but I belong to another world." And then he started saying some things that they didn't sort of recognize at first, but it's a context for us, for a statement he makes I want us to think about. In verse 24, he said, "That is why I told you that you will die in your sins, and you will die in your sins if you do not believe that," and my Good News translation has quotation marks, "I am who I am." Why is that in quotation marks?
Because Jesus was saying that he was Yahweh.
Yeah. This is the Old Testament name, the unspeakable Old Testament name for God.
And that gave those Jewish leaders apoplexy.
Well, not quite yet, because they sort of didn't get the picture. They didn't understand what he was actually saying. "Who are you?" they asked him. You know, they obviously couldn't even comprehend the idea that he might be God. Jesus answered, "What I have told you from the very beginning," and he goes on, gives further explanations, and more arguments. And then we come down to verse 31. So Jesus said to those who believed in him, "If you obey my teaching, you are really my disciples. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And then look at verse 36. "If the Son sets you free, then you will be really free." Now, in terms of our discussion of addictions, is this relevant? Is it possible that these verses, I mean, Jesus is speaking to Pharisees now, and probably some Sadducees as well, to leaders of the nation who are there in the temple trying to trap him? Are we off on our tangent here? Does this have anything to do with addictions at all?
I think it was probably reasonable. From the standpoint, addictions, don't they aren't they involved with some of the pleasure center of the brain?
Mm-hmm.
And my observation is, if you don't stamp sin out, you have to crowd it out. Mm-hmm. You have to replace that whatever it is that's giving you pleasure that's debilitating or causing you to demoralize, all of those D things. With something good.
Yeah.
And what's better than they deal with the Creator?
Okay, now I'm going to be very specific. Were those Pharisees addicts?
Yes. He was getting at them and they didn't realize it. He was pointing out...
What was their addiction?
They thrived on power and wealth. And
power,
all
money, and probably other things that we don't know about.
But I think you could also take it further. Some of these drugs that we see today, if you take them long enough, you lose the power of choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think God can help you get off some of this stuff, but if you've taken it so far, you will never know you're gone.
Yeah. Okay.
Did the phrase, the truth will set you free, if you're a follower of Jesus and you study the truth, that is part of the mechanism that releases you from addiction, mm-hmm. is that you learn the truth. If the Pharisees learned about themselves, well, wasn't it Paul who had his addiction broken on the road to Damascus then?
Mm-hmm.
And he learned about himself and became a different person?
Yeah.
And if the alcoholic learns how he's destroying his body and his family and really has a good hard look, that truth might set him free?
Hopefully, yeah. That's one of the things you have to recognize that you've got a problem or you're not going to work on fixing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people know that they're hurting things.
The fact that they're hurting and they've got a problem has to come first. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get help or they're going to be willing to get help.
Nobody will be more apologetic and recognize their depravity than a drunk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't solve their problem.
No, just recognizing it doesn't solve. No. But recognizing has to come before anything else.
That's true.
But you know, the statement, the truth will set you free, and then talking about chemical dependence and, you know, being free from mm-hmm. that, I think there's a link there, but I don't think that we can come up with something for everybody. They've got to find it themselves.
What freedom was Jesus talking about
well,
in that conversation?
Freedom is freedom. I mean,
okay.
I mean, you're saying what type of freedom?
Well, are we talking about freedom from the Romans?
Freedom from sin.
Still freedom.
Freedom from sin.
They lost their way. They were supposed to be leading the nation in what God wanted, and they mm-hmm. were as far from it as you could get.
Mm-hmm.
And they were this out.
I'm sorry. They were addicted to a round of activities that they thought was going to save them, and they felt inadequate with that, and so they would go at it harder, and it was harder and harder and harder, and the poor people, most of them, just gave up.
Yeah.
There were some
But the guys on the inner circle, they thought this was a way to show their righteousness. Yeah. You know, they look at how hard we're working here, guys.
Yeah, if I don't notice I have a flat tire, I won't do anything about it.
Yeah.
But as soon as I notice it, it's uncomfortable, it's not the way I want to travel,
yeah.
and so then I'll do something about it.
Well, let's talk about some very specific addictions. Take alcohol. That's an addiction that almost everybody knows a little bit about, has heard about, knows about some of the bad effects, etc. And we need to know a little bit about this process. And first of all, alcohol is a chemical class. There are many, many alcohols in the body. Not the kind of alcohol we're talking about here, drinking alcohol, but other kinds of alcohols which do very important biological, chemical processes in the body, and nobody concerns themselves with it. But the alcohol that people consume is called ethyl alcohol or just ethanol. It's very closely related to another alcohol called methyl alcohol, ethanol, which is a deadly poison. Now, what's the difference between ethanol and methanol? Well, it's a very tiny chemical difference, but it turns out that it makes a huge difference in what happens in the body, and let's see if we can understand that. How's alcohol produced? Drinking alcohol now, let's leave aside all those other kinds of alcohol. The alcohol people drink, how is it produced?
Fermentation.
They take perfectly good, high-carbohydrate food. It could be anything from grape juice to corn to sugar cane juice to almost anything that's got a lot of carbohydrate in it. They put in these organisms. They're living organisms. We call them yeast, but... And then what happens? The organisms grow as fast as they can based on the amount of food they can take in and so forth like this. They collect everything of food value that's in there. They metabolize it. And the waste product is alcohol. The waste product is alcohol. Eventually, one of two things happens. Either they run out of food or the alcohol level gets so high they can't live at it anymore and they die. Sometimes we take the yeast and take it out and dry it and process it a little bit, clean it up, package it and sell it to people in what we call brewer's yeast. It has a lot of vitamins and other things in it, and that's where all the food value is. But we take the waste product, we bottle it up in fancy bottles and sugar it and flavor it and do various other things with it.
Put
labels on it and advertise it and sell it for high prices. So,
is it the wine maker's job to catch the liquid at just the right stage of waste so that it tastes good? He can't let it go too far, but it has to go far enough. And so that taste is really the taste of waste.
Yes, I
waste. I like that.
That's a beautiful thing.
It's a very specialized,
very
job that takes a brewmaster many years, and depends what they're making, beer or spirits.
Oh yeah,
right on up through the real heavy stuff.
Yeah,
it's interesting that you're using the word waste as if it's negative.
Well, this is a waste product from these organisms.
I know, but if you look at a plant, it gives off oxygen as a waste product. That isn't waste for us, but then we give off
carbon dioxide
as waste product.
Uh-huh. But the trees and the plants live off carbon dioxide. So.
Just to say, it's waste, and that's the reason why it's bad, that's kind of a little bit stretching things a little bit.
No, it's still true.
Well, the difference is maybe you cannot put anything in alcohol that is a waste product and it lives. Can you put... put something around a tree and it'll live.
We'll die if we run out of oxygen, and a plant won't grow if it runs out of
So we need each other's waste, but who needs
don't take that too far.
It's true. I mean,
who needs the yeast waste, you know?
What we're leading up to is basically ethanol. You can drink that for a while and you get away with it. Methanol will kill you, some people, right on the spot. And if you're lucky, you'll live and go blind. Either way, you're at a loss. But ethanol is a longer-acting one.
So it's a play on words. I mean, Gary has a point.
Yeah.
Is ethanol what they put in cars?
They take good food product, good acreage that you can make food to feed people with, and then they put it in cars and burn it up.
Okay, so the ethanol is the poisonous, and the alcohol
is good.
Ethanol is not good, but it's possible to be used safely for various purposes. And now we're going to talk about what happens. Just to finish out the metabolism thing, when ethanol gets to your liver, where it's metabolized, it's changed first from ethyl alcohol into ethyl aldehyde, which is a deadly poison also. But fortunately, the liver fairly quickly changes it from the aldehyde into the acid, which is called acetic acid, and then the body can break that down and use it. So even the metabolism of the ethyl alcohol, the stuff that's supposed to be safe, goes through a very dangerous step. The problem with methanol is it gets to that step and it doesn't get beyond it. And it's just very, very dangerous poison. Now the question, of course, is we've talked a little bit about the metabolism now. Why is this stuff is addictive?
It's fun. It gives you a buzz. It makes you feel happy.
Yeah.
Of course, you feel sick the next day, but...
yeah.
It depends how old you are.
Having never experienced it, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well... It can be very clearly demonstrated that as you take in alcohol at a very low level, it starts to basically put the frontal part of the brain to sleep. And the more alcohol you drink, the further back in your brain goes to sleep, until if you kept drinking enough of it, you would die. And people who... What usually happens, of course, is that somebody stops them from drinking at that level, or they get so drunk that they can't take in anymore, and we call them dead drunk.
Stop breathing, and it's all over.
Yeah, if you kept drinking enough to the point where you got that level of deadening all the way down to your brain stem, you're dead.
Permanent cure.
Die in a drunken debauch, is that what you've done? You've just turned off your respiratory center?
Yeah.
And the final end of
it. Exactly. Well...
Or there may be some other mechanisms prior to that. You may have gotten so drunk that you vomit and
there are other mechanisms that potentially
aspirate that and get pneumonia. And
but people and so don't on. Go that far. Maybe the true alcoholics. Most people like the deadness of your brain, so okay. that you don't feel critical. Yeah. Other people don't criticize you. I mean, some of these things that are good happens to people in groups where there's no alcohol. I mean, when they use alcohol, but then of course it gets carried away, and then things turn really bad. They could shoot each other, have fights, or whatever. But there's that small area where it is very rewarding, and that's what hooks people, and then they go. I mean, you can't deny that there is something that people really like about alcohol.
What happens is the first areas to go in a brain are the inhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
And
they
don't
feel shy anymore.
The judgment
centers.
All of a sudden,
they're a good singer.
They're just having a wonderful time. They can sing well. They can do everything better than they ever could before, etc. And people like that.
They think they can sing.
Yeah.
Right. I'll be the judge of that. Huh?
Well,
others listening may not feel the same way.
Well, if they're drinking, you know.
If everybody's drinking, they may sound great.
So these portions of the brain that are put to sleep are really the portions of the highest cognition,
yes, exactly.
The highest godlike features, the mm-hmm. highest forms of brain function that we have.
Are right,
controlling
exactly.
our inhibitions.
Yes.
That's where God communicates with you, is yes. the frontal portion of your brain.
Those the spiritual qualities of the mind.
Yes. So, mm-hmm. someone, presumably it was Solomon, although we can't say for sure, in the book of Proverbs, apparently had some experience with this kind of stuff. He wrote in Proverbs 23, starting with verse 29, these words. And I'm reading from my Good News translation. Show me someone who drinks too much, who has to try out some new drink, and I will show you someone miserable and sorry for himself, always causing trouble and always complaining. His eyes are bloodshot and he has bruises that could have been avoided. Don't let wine tempt you, even though it is rich red, though it sparkles in the cup and it goes down smoothly. The next morning you will feel as if you've been bitten by a poisonous snake. Weird sights will appear before your eyes and you will not be able to think or speak clearly. You will feel as if you're out on the ocean, seasick, swinging high up in the rigging of a tossing ship. I must have been hit, you will say. I must have been beaten up, but I don't remember it. Why can't I wake up? I need another drink.
Well, you know, that's the body's physical reaction to the poisonous chemical you have put inside it. And also, it's a classic in a bar. Have you heard the phrase, crying in your beer?
Mm-hmm.
And so people tend to really feel sorry for themselves after they've had alcohol.
You know, I was listening.
So it's a depressant. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was listening to what you were reading there, and I almost feel that way when I eat too late at night.
Yeah.
whoever wrote this, 33 to me, your eyes will see strange things. That's hallucinating, and maybe even the DTs, which is a very high death rate. Somebody had been through the mill here, whoever.
Exactly. My point exactly, yeah.
They either observed very well, or they'd been through it themselves.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Solomon probably had the personal experience.
Which I don't think anybody here has, right?
I
have nursed a lot of them.
Huh?
I said I've nursed a lot of them, had some die on me. It's not pretty.
Yeah. These days we hear a lot of discussion in the health circles and in the public media, national media, about how if you drink a small amount, and apparently it's two drinks for men and one drink for women, and they've got it all defined down, this is a marvelous thing to make you live longer because it preserves your heart. Hmm. Well, there may be a little bit of beneficial effect for the heart, but you notice they're not talking about the liver and they're not talking about the brain. They don't talk at all about what it does to those organs. And you can't feed alcohol to your heart and not feed it to your liver and your brain. And for the rest of the body, basically, alcohol is a very bad poison. It's a very has harmful effects all over the place. And the fact that it may be slightly helpful for the heart isn't a reason to drink it.
And who finances the studies?
Yeah, wonder who.
Also, you have to look at what does it do to your marriage and your relationship with your friends?
Yep. Your financial well-being.
Financial well-being.
And not only that, half of the accidents and a very high percentage of crimes committed in our country are alcohol-related. Think of how many people die every year because of alcohol-related crimes and accidents. Huge sums of money are expended or lost to treat alcoholism, or perhaps because of the loss of work and productivity due to alcohol consumption. Many families are destroyed, and spouses and children permanently damaged by a drinking adult.
I think we need to expand this. In alcohol, we're might talking to an older group. With the young folks, it's more the drugs, and also what is really happening now is psychiatrists, psychologists, would probably be psychiatrists that can prescribe pills. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a Wall Street Journal article on the percentage of young folks, even before they're teenagers, that are already on anxiety pills, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And then these kids learn if they take two or three or four, they get this high. And like I knew this one gal who would go to the emergency room and say she was in an auto accident to get the pain pills and never was in an accident. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just the alcohol, and also these pills come from a medical doctor.
Yeah. Yeah, and sure, there are medicines intended for the relief of pain, for various other things that can be very addictive as well. We know about those things. It's a well-documented fact that approximately one-seventh of all people have a tremendous addictive potential within themselves. We don't know. I can't look around here and say which one of you might be an addict or which one of me might be an addict. But this is the fact. You give alcohol the first drink to 100 people who've never tasted before, and one out of every seven, that'd be 14 out of that 100, more or less, will end up being alcoholics.
Just sort of have a theory why the Adventist Church does so well. It teaches you discipline in very gentle steps, mm-hmm. the Sabbath, your diet, and when you start getting victory over controlling mm-hmm. your behavior, then these bigger addictions seem to mm-hmm. take less effort because you're being trained.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't get the idea that that problem doesn't happen in the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
It's everywhere.
It probably...
It's probably worse than you think, but...
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere, yeah.
All
yeah.
levels of society.
Yeah. Well, nevertheless, the church has taken a very clear stand on this subject, and we've managed to keep ourselves away from it more than other groups by and large. Unfortunately, it's very common for people caught in the alcohol trap to feel like they're hopeless, that there's nothing to be done for them, their condition is impossible to repair, and of course, the devil is delighted to have people feel that way, because what do you do when you feel like that? Have another drink, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about another addiction. Tobacco is one of the most addictive substances known to man. Its pervasive nature in the body is still being discovered by medical science. There are probably thousands of different poisonous substances found in tobacco smoke. Children who grow up in homes where smoking is practiced are twice as likely to develop lung cancer, even if they themselves never smoke in their entire lives. Almost every cancer that you can name has been linked in one way or another to smoking. Heroin, cocaine, amphetamine addictions are well-known and devastating to whole groups of people. Joanne, you mentioned the young people really getting into that stuff. What you're finding on campuses, however, these days is a lot of young people are, because alcohol is more acceptable publicly, they binge drink on the weekends. Mm-hmm. And that's a really dangerous thing to do. But coming back to our heroin, cocaine, etc., recently we've observed that the border between Texas and Mexico has become a war zone, basically, over who's going to bring the drugs in and who's going to profit from them. Many famous people have died of overdoses. We can think of Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley, just to mention a couple. Many others could be named. And they probably were primarily addicted to prescription drugs, as you mentioned. There are things which are, you know, used for legitimate purposes, which can be abused. And, I mean, we've already mentioned food. I mean, and sex has a natural normal function, but it can be an addiction. Don.
Ken, I'm older than all of you, and I have seen these things grow through the years. Mm-hmm. It used to be in church groups and so forth, smoking a cigarette. That was terrible. Mm-hmm. Now, people come to church dead drunk on drugs. Mm-hmm. So it isn't getting better. It's getting worse. Mm-hmm. And everything we can do, we need to do.
Well, coming to church may be a good thing. Maybe they'll get some help, but no, you're right.
Maybe they won't know what's going on even.
It's true.
Do in periods where there are recessions, depressions, and that sort of thing, do the addiction levels increase or decrease? I would imagine that they increase. We're going through tough times.
Yes.
And people find no way out, and they escape through an addiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, why do we sin? How's that for a question?
It seems right to us. It seems like what we want to do.
It's our rebellious freedom.
Freedom.
Freedom in.
Well, it gets back to addiction. The more you do it, the more you're going to do it if you don't work on it.
Yeah.
I'm going to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's the I want to part that is common to all of them.
Yes.
When you ask that question, you sound like the sin isn't built into us.
Well, whether it's built in or whether it's not built in, we still do it. And the question I'm asking now is why do we do it? And if you're going to say it was built into us, therefore we don't have any choice, then I'm going to say, no, that's not what I read in my Bible. We do have choices.
Well, we have choices to get away from its effects and its final outcome, but yeah. I don't know if we could be born and say that we're not.
Oh, if you're talking about being born and claiming that you've never sinned or something like that, no.
That's what I meant by built in.
Okay.
I heard one person say we're corrupted, that we have the tendency to, and we have to deal with it, that we are born corrupted. We aren't born sin. We don't sin when we're born, but we're born with the tendency to sin. We have that corruptible nature in us.
The scriptures speak of sin as a kind of slavery. Is that an accurate representation?
And addictions are slavery. Yeah.
Addictions are slavery.
But just as well characterize it as a disease.
Uh-huh.
Isn't it?
A disease.
You're not, it's not the healthy way to do things. It's something you need to be healed from.
Mm-hmm.
Saved, healed.
We could go around the table here and we all could mention a whole bunch of evil effects that sin has.
Jim reminded me of something. Doesn't the word save really mean salve?
Well, it's very closely related, yes.
And salve is for healing, so
yes.
Save is very close to healing.
The Greek word for salvation or to be saved is sozo, and the Greek word for healing is sozo. Healing and salvation are exactly the same in the original Greek.
So God...
The New Testament Greek.
The God saves us by healing us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's comforting.
Yeah, yeah. Well... How do we explain addictions for necessary things like we've mentioned already, food, sex, and even money? I mean, we basically can't live without, at least the society, you could say we can't really live without food and money in our society. Maybe you could live without sex, but the society wouldn't survive without sex. We have to reproduce, don't we? So these are necessary things. So what do you do with an addiction that you have to have a little bit of it, but you don't want too much of it? They're not bad, right?
Just struggle.
That's called...
struggle.
That's called temperance. Is
temperance.
That the word,
self-control.
Temperance?
Self-control.
Yeah. What you do with it.
And also, more of a thing is not always better. I mean, so you like an apple, but if you eat a bushel of apples, you get sick. Temperance keeps it in that range of where it is healthy, fun, and that sort of thing.
You know, it's the difference between one apple and three apples, not one apple and a bushel.
Okay.
Three apples.
Three apples is okay.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Maybe well,
let's
you
make
get
it
up
five
to six.
Then. That might be a little...
Well, then you start pushing out of temperance. I guess it's a gray line.
What I'm saying is you don't have to eat a bushel to get outside of temperance.
Yeah.
Oh, uh-huh.
How can you have a little bit of addiction and temperance at the same time?
Well, that's what I'm trying to... I'm trying to get us
I mean,
to that.
It seems like they're kind of opposites here.
A little bit of pregnancy.
Yeah.
Some people who, as opposed to an addiction to food and become obese, they have an aversion to food and are anorexic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, both are forms of illness.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to have that middle road, that middle ground.
Oh, we're talking about balance.
Yeah. Is God's plan of the Sabbath to snap us out of our ways each week and to give us balance by spending one day with Him?
Sounds good to me.
So when we go back to it, all of a sudden work doesn't seem as compulsive as it did Friday night. And I don't know, to me it seems like sometimes the Sabbath is like a mechanism that just snaps me out of it.
Good.
Well, that doesn't work for everybody.
Oh.
That's the problem.
Could you be addicted to Bible study?
Yes.
Yeah, I know. I've heard of Jewish people studying the Bible or reading the Bible so much that they're reading it all the time. They actually don't have a life.
Uh-huh.
That
barely eat properly, barely see the sunshine, barely exercise, but they keep at it.
I wonder what's making them, what the point is, but it seems like they just keep going at it.
I admire people who really study the Bible and know it. Like we had one guy, he was from the Research Institute or something, sit at our table at potluck. Someone asked him a question. He got open his Bible. He could quote. He could find. He could tell us. I mean, the answer was so thorough. And that person, I think, was addicted to Bible study. But boy, it was valuable.
Mm-hmm. I don't think
Was he balanced?
Contradiction of terms to me.
Was he balanced in other areas? That's what you have to look
at.
Yeah. And
now,
you have to have the experiences in you got to have the experiences in life to interpret this thing, though. But if you're reading it all the time.
No, I would say he was better than me as a person, but he had spent more time in his Bible, and I think he was addicted. I think it made him a better person.
Yeah, but you're using addicted, and that's confusing me. I don't know what you mean by that.
Okay, how many hours of Bible study a day is addicting? We're at the apples
now. Wait.
One hour, 2 hours, 3 hours?
You might be getting into my territory now. I got to be careful. Let's just say that something, if it becomes obsessive, uncontrollable, and destructive.
Unbalanced.
It's an addiction. And God is prominent.
Who's going to decide what's balanced? Some imbalanced public?
No. Well, I think God is the one.
It's getting hurtful in some directions, and you're not dealing with it. I mean,
somebody's got to make that decision.
Well, a person probably has a problem.
Everybody will have to make it for themselves. That's the challenging part. Yeah. Don.
When I was with Kentucky, Tennessee, Elder Pingenot was the pastor. He had been the pastor in Battle Creek. And on Sabbath afternoon, we would have a meeting, and you could ask any question you wanted. Mm-hmm. And he would answer it from the Spirit of Prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
And he would quote it word for word. And if you quoted it back and misquoted a word, he'd tell you that word isn't in there.
I see.
Now
be careful, huh?
Yeah, you had to really be careful with him.
Was he translated?
Well, some of this probably...
I don't know. He's passed away.
Some of us probably remember HMS Richards. That man was nearly blind for years.
Mm-hmm.
He used to have his Bible and open it, and he would give it word for word. Never looked at it. He learnt it.
Yeah.
He was a very balanced man that I ever read about and knew of, and one of my good friend's daughters married into the family. And you never heard a bad word about him. It's when they get off the track that things go awry.
It was his business.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
it was his job.
Norm brought up a good thing. Who is the judge or the standard of what's balanced and what's not balanced? That's a difficult one.
I'm the judge.
If you look at some of the psychiatric definitions, it will bring in what their peers this race, this standard of education, yep. there's
their
a comparison
done,
exactly,
their
all of that. That's what determines it in our society anyway.
In the scriptures say that your peers, the people around you, will think you're a great guy and guarantee you're going to heaven, or will they think you're a kook?
Again, it depends on...
They thought Jesus was a cook.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, at what point in history does the public made a right judgment on righteousness?
Yeah, but there are some kooks. They'll read the Bible and take care of their M16 in this hand, and... And what are you going to do? Tell them, well, who are we to judge that guy?
A lot of it is societal.
Yeah,
I'm just saying, I don't think society is a very good judge of what is too much Bible and what is not too much Bible.
Well, let's look at a couple of other things. We're scanning through addictions here. The sexual addiction was mentioned earlier. The Bible is very clear on what is appropriate, what the scripture thinks are appropriate for a sexual relationship. Proverbs 5, 18 and 19, and I'm again reading from my Good News Bible. So be happy with your wife. Find your joy with the woman you married. Pretty and graceful as a deer, let her charms keep you happy. Let her surround you with her love. Doesn't that sound like a good plan? Paul over in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians 7, 2 to 5 puts it this way. But because there is so much immorality... Now, would this be something has something to do with addictions, possibly? Every man should have his own wife. Every woman should have her own husband. A man should fulfill his duty as a husband, and a woman should fulfill her duty as a wife, and each should satisfy the other's needs. A wife is not the master of her own body, but her husband is. In the same way, a husband is not the master of his own body, but his wife is. Do not deny yourselves to each other unless you first agree to do so for a while in order to spend your time in prayer. But then resume normal marital relations. In this way, you will be kept from giving in to Satan's temptation because of your lack of self-control. I tell you this not as an order, but simply as a concession. Actually, I would prefer that all of you were as I am. But each one has a special gift from God, one person this gift, and another one that gift. So, of course, some of you are going to say, well, what did Paul mean, be as I am?
Well, you're saying that the Bible gives guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And so for any abnormal addictive behavior, if you're outside the Bible guidelines, that is abnormal. And not outside the society guidelines, but outside the Bible guidelines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, clearly, we can see that marriage and the Sabbath were the two original gifts that God gave to humanity. These were new things. They apply only to our world. The Sabbath doesn't apply anywhere else. It's here because it has to do with the way our world spins around, how fast it spins around, etc. Marriage, the same thing. We are a new and distinct order of beings, Ellen White tells us. So these are very specific gifts to human beings. Is it any wonder that Satan has gone to such incredible lengths to destroy the Sabbath and to destroy marriage? Because he knows that, understood and participated in correctly, they can be a huge blessing to human beings. And why would Satan want any of us to be blessed?
Because Satan wants to destroy God's creation.
Yep. Well, unfortunately, the entertainment industry understands the power of addictions very well. First through books, then plays, and you can look at the history. I mean, I don't think I need to tell any of you that. Movies, and finally television, they have honed temptation to a fine skill. Now, through the internet, they have put almost every kind of temptation you can name right on your desk. These things are not new. Prostitution has been called the oldest profession. But the devil, in these final days of Earth's history, has found new and exciting ways of making it available, even through electronic means. Pornography and what they call cyber sex is available to almost everyone. How are we supposed to develop the spiritual strength and resources to do as Joseph did? And you remember his story in Genesis 39. Potiphar's wife wanted to go to bed with him, and Joseph said, no, I can't do such a thing and sin against God. Well, sex is such a private matter that it is difficult even to help people who are involved because they are embarrassed to talk about it. How do we convince them, and perhaps ourselves, that God can provide freedom from any kind of addiction? Let's talk about one more before we run out of time. 1 Timothy 6:10 is a verse that's quoted often and often misquoted from the Bible. My translation says, "For the love of money is a source of all kinds of evil." The love of money is the source of all kinds of evil. What do you think Paul had in mind when he made that statement?
Well, I have a friend that surprised me to no end, but he's very religious, very spiritual, and whatever. And I found out he lost his job because of he was hooked on the lotto, of all things. That is the most, that's the softest form of gambling you could do. Mm-hmm. But this guy, he had to spend money on these tickets, and he got in trouble with some friends at work that he was borrowing money from, and he lost his job. So money, I don't know. They say that that kind of stuff is ill-gotten gain anyway, but it was very surprising to me.
Well, the love of money is an addiction. It's, you know, just overuse of something that in our day we need. You know, since we don't have farms where we grow our own food, we don't, you know, we don't produce everything we need. We have to have money in, as a substitute.
I worked with a fella who was addicted to gambling. Every morning when he came to work, he called his bookie and placed his bets before work started.
Wow.
He had a name. His name was Kroger. He'd call the bookie and say, "This is Kroger," and place his bets. And he just couldn't seem to get by if he didn't do that. And several of the guys in there started betting with him, and I says, "No, I can lose my money a lot easier way than that." I never got involved.
What bothers me is these city community centers for retirees and a lot of clubs. They have a cheap outing going to Laughlin, Vegas, or Stateline with all the older people, and they put them all in a bus, and the ladies want to go because their friends are going, and it's a cheap trip, and then they go and gamble, and then they come back. And they're training them in the way of the thrill of maybe getting free money, which those buildings are not bought by people getting free money. But then you're training these older people who are getting close to the kingdom and close to eternity into becoming addicted to gambling. And it really bothers me when I see the older people I know being bussed off to these gambling trips.
My mother was born and raised in Nevada. Not in a place that's some distance from the gambling places, but nevertheless in Nevada. So in the process of visiting our my grandparents and so forth, we've often traveled to Nevada. My parents one time, I think they were at a convention somewhere, and they met this older lady there, and they started talking to her, and she said she had, her husband, I think, had died and left her a significant amount of money. And every day she would come with a big handful of money down to the gambling place, and she would gamble until the money was all gone, then she'd go home again. That was her idea of how to live life.
It was her company. And and by doing that, you don't allow yourself to develop other company. And by cities doing that for their retirees, they don't allow the retirees to develop healthy places to go.
Was that an addiction?
Yeah. Probably.
It can be, but not always.
Was it an addiction when she says, "I got this much, I want to do that with it, and when it's gone, that's enough"? Is
when
that
you
an
do
addiction?
It day after day after day, and it's harming your relationships with other people.
She does that in the morning. She goes home and does her afternoon activities with other people.
Getting back to your original
question. It's not
question.
According to Bible rules.
I didn't say it was good. I said, is it an addiction the way we're talking about addiction
tonight? Let me tell you about another person I know about. I had a very close friend who actually worked for a gentleman who lived quite a ways away from Reno, Nevada, where a lot of gambling took place. And he would go fairly often, drive a long distance there, and before he got to Reno, about 20 miles out of town, he would stop by the road and put some money under a rock so he'd have enough money to get back home again. Yeah. Now, that's an addiction.
That's an addiction.
Well, he's got some level of self-control.
But that, at least do that.
He knew he had to have some to get home.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, Jesus has talked about, I mean, he talks about the talents. So he talked about intelligent ways to use our money, and he intended us to use our money wisely. But certainly gambling is for losers. Why do you think gambling and the love of money is such a compulsion? Is it that we just love to use it in flagrant ways? Or?
Well, it's either for excitement, or they think that this is going to solve some problems if they can win.
Make me money and not work for it.
One of the saddest stories in the New Testament is the story, of course, of the rich young ruler who came to Jesus. And he watched for a while, and it comes right after the time when Jesus was blessing the children. And he thought, man, I'd like one of those blessings for myself. And he even wanted to be a part of Jesus' group. And Jesus said, you know, you have to set aside your other god. You have to go and sell what you have and come and follow me. And in Jesus' day, it was believed that if you were rich, that was proof that you were godly, because, you know, if you get rich because God blessed you. See, they believed that. So he said, Jesus in effect said to him, well, if you give up your proof of your godliness and come follow me, then you can be religious. I mean, think about that. Well, in our last couple of minutes here, last minute, certainly a God would agree that we should care for our bodies in the best possible way. We should get enough exercise, avoid obesity, and avoid other addictive and damaging behaviors that make us look prematurely old. But spending endless amounts of money to try to recover our youth, when that money could better be spent promoting the kingdom of God, where we would be eternally young, not just young for a little while longer, but eternally young, is certainly not in God's order. God has given us marvelous bodies, which tend to repair themselves, to recover from illness, and to generally serve us very well. But so long as we live in this world of sin, the death rate will always be the same, and that is one per person. So the Bible talks, in Ecclesiastes 10, 16, and 17, Solomon talks about the fact that all of us will be benefited if we keep God as uppermost in our lives and don't give into these kinds of addictions. Christians know about the dangers of addictions, and we hope you do too. We hope you've enjoyed our discussion. See you next week.